Good evening, good evening, good evening, good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber. Thank you for that applause, much appreciated. I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library, and my goal, as all of you know, is to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance. In effect, I had the pleasure of taking Antonio Damasio and Marina Abramovitz up to the reading room, and Antonio's question was, how high are the ceilings in the reading room? And I have no idea. Does anybody here know? Nobody knows. I thought I had a very sophisticated group of people here. Well, in effect, I've never really posed myself that question, but I have posed myself the question, which is why I say this each and every time at every introduction, which is, I wonder how heavy this institution is. Does anybody know? I would really love to know. And my goal, quite simply, however heavy it is to make this institution dance. I don't know exactly what kind of dance, but to make it jive, to make it come alive. And to make that happen, what I do is I invite the most brilliant, the most entertaining, the wisest, the deepest, the funniest, and people you wouldn't suspect would naturally come to the library, like Keith Richards a couple of weeks ago, or on Monday, you may have heard, we will have the pleasure of welcoming here to the library Cornel West and Jay-Z, and we will be, Cornel West and myself will be interviewing Jay-Z. What that will do will be probably a bit like tonight, an experiment. We won't quite know where the conversation will go, but I think it will be rather interesting. Remaining this season, there's also next Friday coming up, Siddhartha Mukherjee will be joined by Nicholas Wade. Siddhartha Mukherjee wrote a book which is coming out next week called The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. You will be reading about it this weekend. It's quite tremendous. Cancer becomes a protagonist. We also have an evening on the National Lampoon, which ends our season. We began with Stephen Breyer. We end with the National Lampoon. We begin the season in January with a tribute to Gypsy Rose Lee, in case you were curious. And we have an evening with Derek Walcott, and in a week's time I'll be interviewing Zadie Smith. I'd like to thank Joe Dolce for bringing this event to my attention. Thank you very much, Joe. And I want to let you know that there will be a book signing after the event. I haven't asked Marina if she will sign books. We will see. But I imagine that Antonio Damasio will. And Antonio Damasio, in case you don't know, is the director of the University of South California's Brain and Creativity Institute. I'd love to be able to say that I run a creativity institute. Damasio's books include Descartes' Error, Emotion, Reason, and the Human Brain, The Feeling of What Happens, Body and Emotion in the Making of Consciousness, named one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times, and Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. He lives, I believe, in Los Angeles. Marina Abramovitz is a New York-based Serbian-Montenegrin performance artist who began her career in the early 1970s. Abramovitz explores the relationship between performer and audience, the limits of the body, and the possibilities of the mind. And I'm particularly intrigued by how the conversation will go tonight. I think it will really be an essay. We will see how it develops. In his new book, Self Comes to Mind, Antonio Damasio discusses how the brain uses emotion and feeling to create a sense of self in animals and in humans, and how the elaborate version of the human self opened the way for creating the tools of culture. Tonight, he is perhaps surprisingly joined in conversation by Marina Abramovitz. Marina Abramovitz has long tested the relationship between the audience and the ego of a performer. Her last exhibition, retrospective, in New York, staged at the Museum of Modern Art, with the artist is present. I hope many of you have went to see it. A 700, and here I really like the precision, a 736-hour and 30-minute static, silent piece in which she sat immobile in the museum's atrium. I wrote to her somewhere around March. I don't know if she remembers this, but I wrote to her and I said to her that I wanted to invite her to the New York Public Library. And I got a response. I'm not sure if she wrote it, but the response was, Marina, Abramovitz will remain silent until May the 31st, and she looks forward to being in touch with you after that date. Well, tonight is such a date. And Marina Abramovitz considers each public appearance as an experiment, and she never rehearses. I do want to, though, provide you with some full disclosure here. We did have one phone conversation together with Damasio and with Abramovitz, and I think that they've met before. I do not know if they are friends. On the conference call, we spoke but didn't say too much, partly because I did much of the talking, from fear that a lot might be lost in the green room. And as it is said very often, improvisation is something you prepare. I think you prepare it only to a point, and the dance happens on stage. Now it is my great pleasure to bring to the stage the person who considers herself, maybe affectionately now, the grandmother of performance art. I'm thrilled to invite to this stage Antonio Damasio and Marina Abramovitz.
This is completely unrehearsed.
We have to start because he made the book. I didn't.
Okay, very good. So let's start by saying welcome, good evening, pleasure to see you all here. I thought that you would be driving up to the Hamptons on this beautiful day and trying to enjoy a great weekend. Glad you came. Can you hear me at the back? Oh, very good. They did say that the chin was the place, but one never knows. So the other great pleasure is that I'm here with Marina. Marina is an artist that I admire and an artist that I like, and I even like her personally, so that's, quite a lot. The occasion, as you obviously know, is about the launching of a new book, a book that is called Self Comes to Mind. The title explains a good part of what the book is all about. It's about the arrival of this process called the self into a mind, which is essential, in my view, to generate a conscious mind. So you can have a very plain mind, but unless that mind has, in addition, a process of self, that mind will not be conscious. There is a subtitle to the book, and that is Constructing the Conscious Brain, and it's there on purpose so that people realize that I'm not going to talk about it, for example, from the perspective that Marina can talk as an artist, not being involved in neuroscience. I'm going instead to talk about the conscious mind and the generation of the self from the perspective of neuroscience and neurology. And what I really want to understand is how the brain puts it together. And we'll see what she will ask me, and we'll start a conversation. But I can tell you one thing. It is not an easy process. To have a brain to begin with, but to have a brain capable of creating a conscious mind is really one of the most spectacular orchestrations that you can have in the entire universe. We're really talking about the most complex system in the universe that is producing something very beautiful, complex, and very dignified, which is the human mind as we know it. And it is something that I would like to dispel the myth that there will be, for the mystery of consciousness, any solution of the type that we have found for example, sometimes the cause of one disease or some aspect of one's biology, which can be given in a very, very short soundbite. Nothing like that is ever going to happen with consciousness, precisely because it is so complex. So we'll always be talking about something that is generated from the working together of numerous parts of the brain, not one, not two, not ten. the many, many parts of the brain, working in time, pretty much like musicians in an orchestra can work trying to produce produce the performance of a musical piece. Something that is really quite magic about the musical performance that we can call the conscious mind is that it is not written beforehand. So whereas a great conductor in front of a great orchestra can have everyone with their respective scores and can produce music according to what is written in the score with some freedom of interpretation on the moment, we actually don't do that. We do something much more beautiful and much more mysterious, which is that we are writing the score as we go. Not only that, we do not have a conductor in the house, which really means that as we go, we're both generating the score and we are generating the conductor, this illusion of a conductor that is guiding the performance, but in fact only arises once the performance begins. So this is a very, it's almost paradoxical in its, when we present it this way, but this is, I think, the most accurate way in which I can summarize it rapidly. So this being my beginning, time to hear from Marina.
So when I read this book, I really got scared. Because being an artist and reading, you know, book, this kind of book, is so difficult because there's so many terms you don't understand at all. And it's so much about neurons and protons and you know, the left hemisphere of the brain, the right hemisphere of the brain, and so many different explanations. So I was thinking, okay, I read the book, but now I really try to forget like I didn't read and start really like all over new. There's so many questions that I wanted to ask, you know, the scientist, which I really don't have answer, because artists always work from intuition. They don't use as much rational part of the brain. They... ideas come like some kind of mirage, like a three-dimensional, you know, the hologram image in the space. And then if idea is really interesting and you become obsessed by an idea, it's a good way to, you know, to get really into it and realize and to see how that works in real space and real time. But the, all these things, you know, come in somehow, we can call inspiration, we can call state of mind, we can call ecstasy, we can call so many different things. And I'm always interested which part of brain we are using it. What is this all about? But before all that, I would like to start with a very simple question, because as a Paul start all event talking about weight or how high is this space. So my simple question, how much weight the brain?
How much does it weigh?
Yeah, how much weight the brain? What is the weight of this brain?
1,200 grams.
How much?
1,200 grams.
1,200 grams.
A little bit more than a kilo. 3 pounds.
It's always the same. Are there differences? Big people or fat people have more brains or less brains, or there's always the same brain weight? No matter what.
Fat people have fatter bodies, but not fatter brains.
So the brain is always the same. That's incredibly interesting.
Well, within limits. So, you know, you cannot imagine that we all have exactly the same number of grams, the same way that we don't have the same weight or the same height or anything like that. So there are small variations, but there is a range that is considered normal. And, you know, if you go to The Merchant of Venice, Shakespeare talks through Shylock about 3 pounds of flesh. And, of course, we're talking about those 3 pounds of flesh that are, you know, in the brain. This weight of the brain is only gathered after you develop and you become an adult. It tends to change with old age. There's some atrophy, and it changes a lot.
You mean become less weight or
less
shrink
weight.
In
yes.
a way?
Yes, and it changes quite a lot if you have diseases such as Alzheimer's disease, in which the weight of the brain is very much reduced.
And then another question which I have is always bothers me, but you know, there was so many experiments made, then when the person die, that 21 gram become lighter. And this is they say that is exactly 21 gram which measure the soul leaving the body. I mean, it's a very artistic question. What do you think about science?
Very artistic question. With due respect, it's entirely wrong. Not to worry about that. That's it. Do you want me to say more?
So there is possibility the soul have the weight.
Well, I think the soul does have a weight, because if you consider the soul the most refined state of our mind, as I do, that has a weight because it is generated by circuitry in the brain in a certain state. And that circuitry, whatever it is at that particular moment in a certain state of mind, will have weight, because it will be the weight of all the neurons that are involved in that circuitry at that moment. But it will not be 21 grams. It will be much more than that.
Did you ever measure?
No, but you can make the calculation, because, you know, look, we've got something in the order of trillions of synapses and many, many billions of neurons making up those 1,200 grams that we talked about. And the circuitry that is engaged in some, for example, right now, if I'm looking at you and you at me, we are engaging a huge amount of, for example, visual cortex that is necessary for us to create neural maps of each other. Not only that, we're creating neural maps of auditory...
Can you just explain to me and to public what is neural maps exactly?
A neural map is a map, the cartographic aspect of whatever it is that you're representing, but in the form of a network of neurons. So you have a network. The network can be, for example, two-dimensional. Imagine it like a simple piece of paper in which you would do vertical lines and horizontal lines, and now you will want to generate some kind of representation of the vase with the flowers. And you will do some dots that will make that representation as an artist. Well, that's exactly what the brain will do by having our retinas pick up on the representation of the flowers, both the shapes and the color, the green and the color of the roses, and all of that is going to be placed in different maps. For example, one map will handle the color, another map will handle the shape. A combination of maps will handle the depth, so that we have a sense of where it is. And so all of those representations, that multiplicity of maps, is going to generate that picture. Now, what happens is that our brains are not picking up on one channel of sensory information alone. So it's not just vision. So right now you're making a map of me, first in your retinas, and that map is being signaled to the visual cortex. In the visual cortex, it is manipulated. It goes into yet other regions of the visual system where it is re-represented. And then the signals from that are being combined with another kind of mapping that is being made with the sound of my voice. So I am producing sound. There's vibration. That sound is being mapped at two levels. One, something has to do with the timbre of my voice, and the volume of the voice. Another that has to do with the fact that I'm producing speech sounds. I'm not singing. I'm not just creating tones. I'm actually clipping all this and producing speech sounds, which are really phonemes in the English language. And all of this is going to be mapped in the auditory cortex. And then you're going to be able to make a joining of the signals from these two maps in yet another part of the brain. So this is a very, very simple process, the process of looking at another person and hearing the other person. And just by itself, it would take a huge amount of real estate space in terms of the brain. So we're talking about millions of neurons that will be involved in creating that constantly. Not only that, in creating that and erasing that when it's convenient. Because, for example, now that I'm looking at the audience, the map that I was creating of you has vanished. I'm no longer looking at you, so I have a completely different map that is being created. And so you can actually imagine, you know, in terms of an analogy, you could imagine somebody who is actually drafting all these pictures. Pictures of sound, pictures of vision. If I touch this chair, I will make a map of the shape of the arm of the chair, but also of the texture of the wood.
But can you say that also this deal with consciousness? You are conscious about this chair. You are conscious about me being there. And then again, you know, what is consciousness? That's something
that's still another layer. So that's still another layer. So you know, you could perfectly well create all these maps. And what it would do is generate a flowing of images, because if each neural map, once it is apprehended in consciousness, becomes an image. By the way, the term image does not correspond exclusively to visual information. It corresponds to, for example, auditory information. You can talk about auditory images or tactile images or olfactory images and so on. So in a plain mind process, you just have a flowing of images in time. You know, think of, for example, the so-called stream of thought, sometimes called stream of consciousness, of William James. He was thinking about this flowing of images.
Or David Lynch.
But, you know, the other came first. All this flowing...
Still of, David Lynch.
All this flowing of images. Now, that by itself does not guarantee consciousness, because, since you ask what it is, to be conscious is to do... go one step up is to have the possibility of pulling together all that information in some kind of aggregate, but in addition being able to feel that you're having that information, because consciousness is not merely about having maps and images, it's about having felt maps and images. It's not just that you're seeing something, you feel that you see something. And that feeling is an obligate accompaniment of perception that is in consciousness. And by the way, that feeling is absolutely critical to build up consciousness. And then, in the end, you're going to add a few more tricks. And let me just outline two or three for you. One is perspective. For example, I am conscious of you being here, I am conscious of the audience there, but that consciousness has to do with the fact that I am perceiving the audience and you in a certain perspective, which happens to be the perspective of my eyes in my head. Imagine that you had a camera and the camera is now panned toward you and I am perceiving in my perspective. You are perceiving me in a completely different perspective. And that's one of the reasons why you know that you have a mind that is conscious, and I know that I have a mind, and your mind is yours, my mind is mine. Not only that, you also have an inevitable sense of ownership. That is part of consciousness. You know that it is your own mind, not the mind of the person that is sitting in the first row. And it's when you put together all that information that you really become aware, in the true sense, of the surrounding world and of your own organism. So the most lapidary and simple definition of consciousness would be the ability to be aware of one's own organism and of the surround of that organism in a felt way. And in a way that allows you to reflect and know that you're really there, you're present, and you know that you have a mind that is achieving all this very complicated
Okay, but stuff. We are talking, this is like, you know, personal consciousness in a certain way, but is this something that we can actually relate to, like universal consciousness or planetary consciousness or mineral consciousness or, you know, forest consciousness or, you know, to go even into different directions, animal consciousness?
Right.
What about this kind of consciousness?
Okay, let's leave aside the animal consciousness, because the animal consciousness, as far as I can see, is very much like our consciousness in general. In other words, I believe quite strongly that animals have minds, at least animals that have complex brains that are comparable to us in the type of organization. They don't need to weigh 1,200 grams, and they don't need to be our size, but they do have minds, And in all likelihood, they have a conscious state. Now, you might say, how on earth do you know that? Have they told you? And the answer is no, they haven't told me, but you can triangulate the situation, and you can say that if an animal behaves in the same situation in which you are, in the same way that you would, and if that animal has a brain with the components that are necessary to create consciousness in ourselves, then we have to presume that that animal has consciousness. Now, that consciousness is not going to be like yours or mine, because we can talk about that later. It lacks certain aspects that are very important, mostly the aspects of autobiography. In other words, we have built in our lifetimes a very complex autobiography, which gives us a sort of narrative arc of our lives, which can be more or less detailed depending on the situation and on what we want to do with it. And we also have in that arc not only a biography that corresponds to the lived past, but to the anticipated future. And this is something that in all likelihood animals may have a little bit of it, but it's very unlikely that they have made plans, for example, for Christmas, or are worried about what treats you will bring home in 3 months. And we are worried about those things because we have been able to plan, we have been able to put those plans into memory, and therefore we even have this thing which is seemingly paradoxical, which is a memory of the future.
But this is also, we can relate to collective memory, because it's a collective memory of Christmas.
Okay, let's go there now. So I want you to get resolved on the issue of animals, because I think that, you know, our consciousness is a biological process, a very complex one, but the consciousness of animals and the minds of animals is also a biological process, and it's part of the same family. It's just a question of where in the history this is located. We are at the current point, sort of the best representatives with the most evolved kind of biology that permits minds and consciousness, and many other animals are, of course, at points that are intermediate, but you can go all the way down and continue to find signals that there's something that could be minded and even selfed, to put it in the right terms. Now, let me deal with the other part of your question, which has to do with the other forms of consciousness that you referred. For example, suppose the Western culture has finally got into its consciousness that we have a climate problem and that there is global warming. That is something that is very commonly used. And what you simply mean is that people are now, in large numbers, aware of the fact that there is climate change. And I think that's the sense in which you mean it. And there's also something that you could talk about, which is a collective consciousness that, say, Americans may have of a certain political situation that we're in right now, or people in the European community, or what have you. What you're dealing with is really just it's a bad use of the term from the point of view of science, because we want we have to have some terminological hygiene, and it would be good to reserve certain terms for certain meanings. And if we use consciousness to mean mind or to mean just awareness in general, we were just making it more difficult to have a dialogue, although it's perfectly legitimate to do so. So,
no, I understand. So, my question is: where this art? What? How? How you see art in all this?
Oh, that's a wonderful question.
In all this.
Okay. And she asks such simple questions. Where is art in the middle of all this? So that's a very tall question, but I think one can deal with it. So let's put it in the following perspective. Something that the animals that I was talking about, with all of their wonderful minds and consciousness, don't seem to have is the ability to reflect on their lives and to create art. This is something, of course, you can...
Not true. not I have example. But oh, yeah. You continue, I will let you know.
Okay, very good. I'm dying to know about animal art.
Yeah, it's really interesting that sometimes animals can make things that is absolutely irrational and not to be explained. There is this incredible example of the little bird, this very tiny little bird, I don't know exactly the name, in Australia, who make this call objet d'art, the objects, art objects. After they're the birds in a bird world who make the most beautiful nests. They take lots of time to take special leaves and the special flowers and the color of the flowers they will rub on the branches so that it creates certain patterns and colors. And then when they finish this very elaborate nest, it's not enough for them. They will start, they lay the eggs and they have, the offsprings. But then they create small objects with a very delicate small objects who are decorated with little feathers and shells from the sea and so on. And they leave them in grass, they leave them in different places on the rocks or, near the water ponds. And there is no any function. Nobody found that it was any function for them, except they are very beautiful objects. And this is really interesting that somehow that this need of the animal to create something beautiful and not useful, because everything in nature is useful. I mean, there is always certain purpose. And this really is almost, close to the art concept.
Okay, very good. I'll come to that, which I think is very interesting. But let's deal with your first question, which is, how come we have developed art as humans? And I will still say that even with the exceptions that you may find, which we have to discuss, I would say that in general, you would agree that animals do not create art. In general. Okay. I will take the exceptions, and I think that the exceptions will be very interesting to discuss. But okay, so let's assume for a minute, with your license, that animals don't create art, but we do, for sure, and in spades, and we started it a very long time ago. So when you go 17,000 years ago to Lascaux, and you find incredible painting, signs of sculpture. There obviously was, you can have hints through other evidence that there was music being played, at least at the level of drumming and the use of flutes. So clearly there were arts in the making at that time. We don't have other records because, of course, there was no written record that you have to wait 12,000 years to get written records. But there's this evidence that is very, very powerful. So why would that emerge? What would be the purpose of it? And some people will say, sometimes in a very self-serving way, that art is useless now, and it was useless then. It was just a fait divers, and it didn't have any role. I don't think so. I think art was very useful then, and it continues to be very useful now in many ways. And the reason why I think it was generated has to do with the fact that humans that were by that time, even if we don't know how much language they had developed at that point, if they had a sense of the life of others and of their lives individually in relation to others, they would have experienced things such as attachment to another. Attachment, for example, to a partner, attachment to progeny, attachment even to objects like, a place of shelter. They would also have experienced, in case the attachment would be broken, as, for example, in the case of death of another, they would have experienced the grief of loss. And it's quite likely because the machinery of emotions that we have now is in all likelihood very similar to the machinery of emotions that those individuals would have. If you go back even 10,000 years ago. In addition, they would have experienced, because of those emotions, all sorts of interesting states, such as, for example, wanting to seduce somebody else, wanted to attract somebody else. And they would have experienced the desire, because they were in a group, to organize the group for whatever purpose. Hunting, war, some kind of worship session. Once you have those needs, you have the possibility of exploiting those needs in an emotional form and in a way that allows, for example, let's take the case of grief caused by loss of another and breaking of attachment. You would have the possibility of using, for example, music to as consolation, music to soothe someone else that would be in loss, or to soothe oneself. You would have the possibility using, for example, something like drumming and patterns of drumming to call people to order, to organize people around that drumming performance. And you would have the possibility of using pictorial art to call attention to certain needs. It's probably not by coincidence that a lot of that pictorial art deals with things that are very, very close to the individual, such as hunting, food, war, sex. These were topics that were very important then, and they're very important still. And so the perspective in which I place the beginnings of art, it's not where art ended, but where art starts, is a perspective of homeostasis. Now, homeostasis is a big, ugly word, but it simply means life regulation. The reason for minds and consciousness and many other things in our lives is the need of homeostasis, the need to regulate our life in such a way that we can survive, and if possible, survive with well-being. And once you discover, because many of these things were discovered by chance, the same way that you as an artist are constantly discovering things that will happen, things that you might not even have wanted to happen, but they happen and you use them as a happy accident. Once they were discovered, they were selected by a group of people, they became important to that group of people, and because the results of the use of that artistic endeavor were that those people probably survived better and in better conditions, you have the possibility of inserting that arrangement of brain into future generations and having genes create brains that are like that. So I think that the beginnings of art could well be around the problem of homeostasis in a very, very general sense. And of course, that was then highly capitalized as life continued. And of course, once you have written records, which begin about 5,000 years ago, and you have the possibility of having a give and take not only on the moment, but a give and take that can go across generations because of the written record, then of course all of this can expand and arrive at where we are today. Now, I need to deal with your animals that make art. I have not forgotten about that. Now, we know for certain that there are some examples of, this is especially so in birds, the birds that use in courtship, use the gathering of, for example, little stones and placing those stones in certain patterns. And it's not just any stone. It will be stones in particular that can shine and that have a different spark to it. And there are patterns that will be made and arrangements that can be made that will make the gatherer of that artistic product all the more attractive to the bird being courted. So in that case, you have examples of something that might be called artistic. And because there is some variation from occasion to occasion, you might push it to the limit and say that's art. Although you still have to deal with the fact that this is not something that you decided to do, the same way that you decided, for example, in the artist is present to do in a certain way at the museum. This is something that is being commended by the genome of that bird that is setting all of these movements, all these actions in motion. It is not being decided with the freedom of deliberation that you had when you decided that you were going to sit at the lobby of the Museum of Modern Art and you were going to be in red velvet as opposed to blue or whatever else. Okay. So the issue of deliberation is a very important one. I had never heard of the other example that you mentioned that seemed not to have a reason. This one does have a reason, and that is courtship. And it produces good effects.
Okay, now, let's talk about things that you can't explain.
Okay.
I have so many examples.
Try me.
One. So there are a few things, like the comment about art. You know, there is a lots of artists who just reflect kind of chronologically what's happening in society and reflect society as it is. But the really great art is made out of great suffering. That's a fact. This is what I just want to say as a fact. I don't want to argue about this. This is how it is.
So you agree with me that there is...
No, great suffering, great art.
Right. So seizing on the idea that there's loss, and of course loss causes suffering.
Yeah, but let's say... drawings of hunting is drawings of hunting, not great suffering, but really great suffering. It's a drama.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I agree.
So there is so many things that which you know I'm really interested in, which doesn't have really rational explanation. And I'll just give you examples, and then you see what you do with them. And I'm going to talk for a while, so you drink your water and, and relax. Okay. Let's start from my own background, Russia. There is this mysterious big meteorite or the talk was antimatter or was meteorite. Nobody ever really explained scientifically, who fall down and make huge crater in Siberia. And there was there was few villages around that area with this antimatter or the meteorite explode, and the people, the peasants, just the simple peasants, especially women who didn't even go to school or not to write or to read, they start having very strange phenomena. And one of the phenomena was telekinesis, that actually can move the objects just by looking at it. So if you have this glass of water, this person, without touching glass of water, can move from this table to maybe another table. In Russia, they made for a parapsychology institute, and one of my uncles was actually a scientist there and stayed for a long time in this institute. And he just told me, I was really young, I was like 18, and it was so interesting to listen to these old incredible stories. He was telling me about this experiment. They took this old woman from Siberia and into the institute to experiment, and she sit on the chair, and there was two tables. And they had all 36-degree cameras around, and the camera was with really high speed to actually, if you can't perceive with your eyes, that you can see what's happening in the camera. So what happened is what you, being in the space, could see is the glass of water on the table, and she's just sitting without any motion. And then in no time, you see the same glass of water on the other table, and without seeing actually this. There was no any kind of transport of the glass to another table. It was just materializing from there, materializing to other place. So they developed the film, and they look in very slow motion, extremely slow motion, what really happened. And on their complete surprise, what they see was the same thing. They see glass of water here, and they see there. So the idea was, you know, one of the scientific ideas was that actually the sheer ability to dematerialize this glass of water and materialize again on another side of the table. Okay, one example. Second example, in Africa, you have Dogon tribes who worship Trans-Pluto, which is a small satellite around the Pluto, who'd been developed only maybe 40 years ago when the telescopes and technology developed so strong that they can actually see that is a trans-Pluto. These people for hundreds of years worship, and in their ceremonies worship this trans-Pluto because they knew it all the way that exists, which is not possible to perceive with naked eye. Then another example, I was participating in this symposium on the between in Frankfurt. It was the symposium between His Holiness Dalai Lama, the chief of Hopi Indians, and the representatives of NASA program, space program. And it was a very interesting symposium because it was really to deal with something that in the Hopi predictions and the Tibetan predictions, there is a story that taking uranium out of the ground will change the molecules of our stratosphere of the planet, and they will create more radiation, from the sun directly to the earth. And they have in the both of these, cultures predictions for thousands of years already existing. And NASA actually very recently found that this is true, that actually taking uranium, you are changing stratosphere on the planet. So what is interesting for me, it's the entire idea that there is a, I'm not talking about religions. I don't like religions so much because they are connected to institutions, and I don't like institutions. But I like the kind of spirituality or like kind of knowledge who you can't scientifically prove. And because we don't have tools to prove it, but doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And then when the scientists prove it finally, then everybody expects it to say, we know it all the way. But actually it's not like that. And there's so many other examples that, especially as an artist, I'm kind of confronting every day. And I wanted to know, do you really believe there is something like universal consciousness? There is some kind of knowledge existing, universal knowledge, that only in a certain state of mind, on a certain state of development, very high state of consciousness, that you actually tap to this universal knowledge. And that's how the great events and how the, Einstein find relativity theory or whatever, Nikola Tesla find remote control connection, they can really, put in a function that actually we can't invent, our brain can't invent anything which already don't exist. And everything exists. We are only kind of reinventing the things that are around, because how the brain can invent something that doesn't exist?
Okay. So,
I have more examples, but let's say just these ones.
So let's deal with something that you just touched on towards the end, which is, can we tap into some kind of very profound knowledge that normally in the day-to-day we do not? And I think that's a very important question, and the answer is yes.
That's good news.
Good. Now,
how?
Now, the question is, what kind of knowledge are we talking about, and how do we get to it? For example, I think you are a meditator, are you not? Yeah. Do you do Tibetan meditation? Tibetan Buddhist meditation? Well, I'm pretty certain that when you do that, you are actually touching on some knowledge that you would not be able to have right now. I mean, once you acquire it, you will have a memory of what you found, but right now you would not have access to that, maybe. You wouldn't. You agree. So, and I certainly wouldn't.
Because we are talking too much,
Exactly.
To get to that kind of state of mind, you have to have stillness, you have to have no thinking state, and you have to be in the present all the way, 100%.
Excellent. So I entirely agree with that. So what we're dealing with is the following. Because we have these very large, complex brains with this incredible capacity for learning, with huge banks of memory that have to do with our, entire lifetime and with the entire lifetime of many other people, because, our biographies incorporate not just our life, but of necessity, the lives of others that have interacted with us. We are an accumulation of our individual lives and of the lives of the social interactions that we have had. And of course, we also have quite a lot of knowledge about the world at large, even a world that we have never seen directly and we have only touched through books or images in movies or television. Okay, all of this is in effect a sort of screen around the reality of our biology. So we have constructed with our cultures a very complex, very robust screen that is constantly blocking the view to things that are very, very simple within us, and mostly to the fact that we are present, that we are living, and that we have this problem of life to deal with. One other thing that has made all of this even more complicated is the development of language. Of course, language is beautiful and marvelous because it has given us literature at the highest point, and it gives us the possibility of being here talking. If we did not have language, it would be pretty difficult to gesture all the ideas that we have been talking about, and it would be impossible for you to understand what we were talking about. And we can do it through language. But language is yet another screen. Language is constantly interposed between us and the reality. Now, what I would like to suggest is that that great reality and that world of possibility is in fact within ourselves rather than outside of ourselves. And I suggest that when you meditate and when you go deep into a very different state, you are actually achieving a state that, from my point of view as neurobiologist, I describe in a new book as a state of primordial feeling. So it's a state in which there is a representation of life, there is the life in the organism, there is an immediate signal that that life is present. There's existence there being signified without any word. It's just there. You sense its presence, and you are being able to do that without having to refer to objects that are in the outside world. You don't need to refer to buildings and other architecture and different structures. You are doing that entirely on the basis of what you find once you go to that into that deep travel. Now, you know that many people will. I'm sure you have experienced that. Once you get to be able to do that, you will have a very special kind of happiness that comes with it, and you could call it enlightenment if you want. But I think the enlightenment is the possibility of sensing something that is very beautiful, which is the presence of life itself. But it is within you. It's been built from our biology, from the cells and tissues and systems that make up our body and that then get to be represented in the brain. And I take a lot of time in my new book to discuss the fact that there is even a point in the brain, not a point, a structure in the brain where you have this sort of near fusion of the body and the brain, and it happens to be something that has existed in evolution for a very long time, and it's largely structures of the brainstem. So I'm taking the position that once you go deep inside, you find extremely important realities. And by the way, there is all room for those realities to literally enlighten you, in addition to having therapeutic effects, because I presume you would agree that once you do that, actually you are less stressed.
Yeah, but what about example, you're running in Central Park and you're jogging and you're completely on the end of your energy and you're not having 1 gram of energy. We are talking about you have to stop because you're going to have a heart attack, how exhausted you are. And you just want to go home and take a shower and, you know, rest. And in this very moment come the man with the gun and say, if you don't run, we're going to kill you. Mm-hmm. What you do? You're running like crazy. From which energy you're running?
Well, you will find the energy to run a bit more.
You're exhausted. You don't have any more energy. I really believe there is universal energy that you tap in, that when you exhaust your own personal energy, there is completely something else which is not any more related to your body.
Well, that's your hypothesis, but I don't think we need to...
We disagree totally.
Yeah,
it's so refreshing.
Yeah, it's so refreshing, yeah, because we agree on many other things. For example, we even have some very interesting examples that come out of neurology. You know that there is a disease called Parkinson's disease, and patients with Parkinson's disease have severe limitations of their movement, and they have very great difficulty initiating movement. And in the days prior to all the new treatments, for example, levodopa and treatments that are now even surgical, patients would be totally confined, you know, arched in their position, confined to a chair, and really unable to go very far without a lot of help. And there are many cases described in the scientific literature of these patients in situations of extreme emergency appearing earlier than anybody else at a point of safety. For example, a patient that lives in a fourth floor without elevator and there is a fire. And by the time everybody goes and looks for that patient to try to save that patient, turns out the patient is already on the ground floor. How come that happened? This very paradoxical energy that allowed the person not only to move, but to move very fast. And there's one very famous case of a patient that was inside a house that was in a flood area, and the patient moved up and up and up to stay away from the flood and saved himself. So that energy actually can be explained, although you don't need to accept that explanation, but can be explained by the sudden release of certain neuromodulators into the brain and into the bloodstream that allows that extra energy. And that release is a very typical phenomenon that is actually achieved by fear. It's the emotion of extreme fear that controls certain responses in the brain and that allows for certain actions, for certain movements, and for the release of these molecules that really function like hormones that are being distributed.
Okay, I understand this, but listen to this. So what about tsunami? Now, we have this huge tsunami. It was such a disaster some years ago. And there is a fact that all the animals and all the gypsies in Thailand who stay on the beach week before tsunami left and nobody been killed from them. So what about intuition? What about prediction of future?
Okay,
what about this kind of stuff?
That's a very...
Where the consciousness goes there?
Well, that's a very interesting issue that has to do with intuition, but intuition that is based on certain aspects of perception that are extremely rich in other species. For example...
Let's put animals away. Let's just talk about humans.
No, but the animals are very important there. The animals are very
important.
Animals
is easy to explain. I want humans to explain.
Yeah, wait a minute, but why do you think animals are easy to explain?
Yeah, because they have instinct for survivors, whatever. You know,
they have instinct for survival,
feel,
too.
They can feel the coming earthquake. All the snakes are following geodetically in line of the earth. Reptiles do the same.
Right.
So that's kind of a biological explanation. But how do humans see this? How we know? How do certain people can predict the future? How do certain people know these events going to happen?
Okay, so
then we come to the point of time in general.
Okay, the way to handle that is as follows. Why not subject all that to a scientific experiment? In other words, it's perfectly fine to have the hypothesis that some people have extra perceptual powers. I would simply like to do the experiment that would show that that's the case. Or to show, for example, that they can bend spoons and forks in some telekinetic experiment. And in situations in which very highly controlled scientific experiments have been made, many of those claims have been found not to hold. Although there are some that are so difficult to control that the results have been equivocal. So I will grant you easily the following, that we are very ignorant, we don't know enough, And it's quite possible that there are untapped powers of the human brain and of many other brains that are not easily explained and accounted for by biology as we know it. That's, for me, that's a given, and we will agree perfectly well on that. I mean, the last thing I want is to have anybody, for example, who reads my books to think that I'm making definitive explanations about consciousness. I take pains to say that I'm not. I am talking about new facts. I'm talking about frameworks to explain the facts and about hypotheses that need to be tested. And they can be wrong. And that's the history of science. You know, sometimes it's wrong, sometimes it's not.
And many times it's not conclusive.
Exactly. Many times it's not conclusive. There are plenty. I mean, look, people have been dealing with quantum physics for a century now. And if, you know, as Richard Feynman used to say, if anybody tells you that they understand the weirdness of quantum physics, they don't know what they're talking about.
Okay, so now.
But of course, our worlds, the world of biological organisms, mm-hmm. such as you and me, exists in a superquantic world. You know, we obey quantum laws, but we are objects of our size, the human size, are objects that can be explained in their movements by Newtonian laws. They don't need at all to be explained by quantum laws.
Okay, now you have to tell me, in your own personal life, something that you could not rationally explain.
Oh my God, there's so many.
Oh, just tell me one. I need at least three. Oh, three is a good number.
No. There are plenty. For example, there.
Such a good thing to ask scientists something they can't explain. I really enjoy this moment. So tell me.
For example, there's certain coincidences that happen to you. Certain things that you say, my God, this is absolutely astonishing that this could happen. But it is one thing to not be able to explain it. It's another to fall into an explanation that, for example, invokes the supernatural. I don't feel obliged to do that. But there are plenty of things in my life that I can't explain, yes.
But give us example. Share with us one.
The person that I'm thinking about, and I have not thought about that person for a long time, and the phone rings, and it's that person.
That's all?
That's all.
This happens all the time to everybody. Come on, something more spooky, more strange, more, you know.
I don't know about spooky. You know, I just can't think of it. But I will think. Maybe after you say some more, I may come up with something. You really want spooky, huh?
No, something that you really... I mean, this thing that we think about somebody is like almost telepathy. I mean, or, you know, you think about some person and this person just phone you or this kind of stuff. I mean, I'm sure everybody... We have these abilities, except we use too much computers, so we forgot it. But the more, you know, more strange stuff, more that you really can't...
That's about the strangest that I deal with.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. There are plenty of weird things, but they're not strange in that unexplainable way. There are things that go wrong. There are things that are not the way you wanted or intended, but that's different. It's not... I can find explanations for them.
Okay, I can share with you some mine then.
Oh, go ahead. Maybe it will make me think of something.
No, it's you know, what is very interesting about strange stuff would happen, there is always some kind of normality about it, and doesn't look really special except when you start thinking, and then you just you know, then you really get completely you know, weird and strange feeling. But when it's happening, that moment looks like everything is normal, but then everything is not normal. So there was very, you know, I don't know, I was like 15 years old, and I had a room I was in Belgrade, and I have a little room. And I have this door, and the door was like really old. It was old house and old door. And every time I would open this door, there would always go this, you know, they need oil in the engine, but nobody ever put the oil. So it was going worse and worse. It make horrible sound and always would bump on the wall. And every time, you know, my mother and father would say, we will fix the door, and then they never did. And then it was this strange thing that I dreamt that this door opened only a little bit and without sound, which is physically impossible. And then I wake up from the strange dream and I put my light next to my bed and I look at the door, and it's just in that moment the door starts opening, and just a little bit, and that halfway, as exactly as is in the dream. It was like 4 a.m, I looked at the watch, nobody was at, you know, everybody was sleeping. And I could not believe, and I was looking and looking for a while, and I was staying in that position, the door. Then I stand up, and I touch the door, and immediately went to this old way, and, you know, with this crack and sound and everything as always. I spent hours to try to fix the door in this position, and never worked. Never could explain. And then another strange thing happened in Australia. You know, I spent 1 year living in Australian desert with Aborigines. It was really important for me. It was very strange. You know, first, the people are nomads, you know, they're nomadic, and the ceremony is a way of life, and they believe in the present time. Everything is about here and now, and they don't have possessions. And it was very similar to being a performance artist. So I really wanted to learn from them many different things, and they have extrasensory perception, they have telepathy and so on. So I, most of the time it was so hot that I could not even move. I was just standing under, you know, sitting under the tree all day long, and in the evening we could eat something. It was incredible heat. I don't know in Fahrenheit, it was over 100. I don't know. It was, everything was burning. The earth was burning. You know, we could, just drinking hot water, that was all possible. And really middle of nowhere. And in this kind of situation, you see, Aborigines are the only people who never use any drugs. They don't have any hallucinative drugs. They don't have the peyote or whatever, like, you know, Mexicans or anything. They don't use anything at all. And so that you don't think that you kind of, you know, you'd use the drugs of Aborigines and then you get into this kind of state. It was totally plain state of mind. And there was no dreaming state of mind. And in the middle of that, I was just sitting under the tree waiting to cool down. I get this like a three-dimensional image in the front of me. And the image was of the place in Amsterdam where I used to live. And I lived together with some friends. We shared the middle space and we have each of us our room. And then I saw in the like three-dimensional the room of these friends of mine who have the who had this room. And her bed was always in the dark corner of the room. And in this image, which I saw like hologram almost, the bed was next to the window. And this was all, nothing special. So I was writing diaries every time I see such an image. So I wrote this diary, and we, 1 year later, I come back to Amsterdam, and I go to her room, and I immediately, instantly remember that image, and I look where is the bed, and the bed was always in the same dark corner, like always. And I say to her, it's so strange, in January, I had this image that came out of nowhere in the front of my mind, that this actually bed was next to the window. And she said, let us see the date. And I showed the date. And she said, at that time she was, you know, visiting her mother. And she ran the place to some Swedish friends. And the first thing they done, they put the, this bed next to the window. And when she came back, they put, she put it back in the same corner. And this kind of stuff, that you kind of perceive something happened so far away, so distant, which doesn't have really much significance, but it was complete reality and in advance.
So let me tell you my reaction to your stories.
And I didn't tell you strange ones, just the simple ones.
They're strange enough. What I would say is this. I think that is perfectly human and the very good thing that we have at this point in our cultural evolution to have two kinds of attitudes that are perfectly compatible with each other, except that you cannot have them at the same time. And one is the yearning to find scientific explanations to everything. And it's perfectly obvious that we can't explain scientifically everything in our universe. We're far from it. But there's also no doubt that we have been making huge progress. And I mean, when you think of where we have gone from the time of Galileo and Newton to our time in not just physics but biology, it's obvious that amazing progress has been made. At the same time, there is a perfectly legitimate, and I think that we all engage in it in some way, a perfectly legitimate yearning for mystery, and for the preservation of mystery, and for respect for things that we cannot easily understand. And I think that sometimes, for example, I would imagine that in some circumstances, because we have that legitimate yearning for the mysterious, and this sort of modesty about explaining everything away, we want to keep something that we regard as more dignified, more pure, more intangible. I think because of that, we can be also persuaded to attribute explanations that may not be right.
Exactly, because we don't even know how life's come on this planet, I mean, to start
right.
with.
So what we have is two things that are perfectly compatible. One attitude which tends towards the mysterious, and where the explanations are very ancient and conform to old wisdom. And another, which is the attempt to explain everything in scientific terms, in very rational terms, which very often gets us into very hot water because it's just not right. But I think that human beings are made of these two tendencies, and many of us have both tendencies inside the same organisms, and some of us have more of one than of the other. It ends up being attitudes towards the world and approaches to the world.
So this is why here you are in the front of two tribes, science and art tribe.
Okay, so...
So I think we should open the... You know, we was thinking how to engage audience, and I really think the three questions will be right measure, because it's late and we should eat... Three questions. What do you think?
So we're the only thing that stands between you and a stiff drink and dinner, maybe. Supper.
So let's see. I don't see anything. Can we save some light to the audience, please? I put my glasses. I only see lights.
There's a question right
yes.
here.
There's a question.
I'm curious as to what was going on in your brain when you were performing the artist as present. Well, I mean, I'm also curious to hear what the professor has to say as well. So
I didn't have scientists to put any kind of the electric mechanism to really, to measure my waves. But what happened in artist is present? It was a very long performance. We are talking about 3 months. And this is like a life itself. And every day was 7 hours, and Fridays was 10 hours, which is a long, long period of time to be motionless. So my idea is to concentrate in really sitting position, try not to even to blink, try to have hardly any movement to the person who is opposite of me, and really to be in a present situation here and now, that I'm not in the past and I'm not in the future. I'm just in the moment, and have to really concentrate on very slow breathing and to kind of make my mind almost still. So the most difficult part is to really not think. Thinking is the most important. Not to think is the most important, actually a condition to be here and now, just to kind of let it be. And the thinking is, automatic. We think all the time. There is only two scientific proofs that we don't think if we sneeze and when we have orgasm. There are only two times that we don't think. Automatically, you can't think in these two moments. But every other moment, the thinking process go on and on. So by sitting for so long, I kind of slow down. Then I really come into this state of not thinking. And then also, which was very important for me, it was... that actually I really literally had out-of-body experience. My body was very painful because after a while, muscles get very, very strained and, your legs got swallowed. It was the moments that on the end of the day I could not even lift my hand to take my clothes off, to my dress off. It was so painful. But during the process when I was there with the audience, there was no pain. There was no any of this kind of discomfort. It was just that kind of pure presence. And it was one of the most kind of opening consciousness experience that I ever had in my life. So I understood that the long durational work in performance is very important. It's important because with long durational work, the performer, like in this case me, can really change his state of consciousness and elevate himself into the different state, and as well as the public, if you take enough time to experience this.
So I think that what Marina was going through, if you see it in my perspective, was placing yourself in a slightly modified state of consciousness, which she was managing mostly at the level of what I call the nuclear self, and the core self, and trying to divest herself of the autobiographical aspects. And that, of course, requires a change in the level of consciousness that that you had at that moment. You had a question here.
Thanks. I'll try and probably fail to ask this clearly. The Chin, is that what you're supposed to do here? Thanks for bringing up the whole process of mapping, which I just read a book about it, and which is so fascinating and fundamental. It feels like something that everybody should know, really understand a lot more about. One thing I was wondering about, I was trying to understand a little about quantum physics recently, and I was reading about time and trying to understand what time is, which is always a mistake. And I was reading, you know, various theories about it, and, you know, one was talking about how, you know, the idea of there being a past, present, and future is very misleading. And I was thinking, well, you know, that in sort of terms of mapping, or under the modality of mapping, our memory sort of serves as a function of, you know, depth perception over time, i.e., you know, like our eyes tell us this is further apart than that is, then our memory does the same function
exactly
in time. Yeah. And that therefore, you know, it's only our memory that serves to tell us that time is something fluid and moving. Otherwise, we would not think it was.
Right.
And that the past, we look at the past as concrete and the future as changeable, which is sort of absurd, really, when you think about it. I mean, as though, you know, by us seeing it, it turns from steam to ice, which mm-hmm. is sort of a... Anyway, I am getting to the question.
Good.
Which is that under this, it almost seems like, you know, we have a memory to see the past. We have a sense. We have eyes that see the past, but we don't have eyes that see the future, which, and theoretically, they should both be there. And it seems like, well, why don't we have that faculty? Do you think that faculty could exist?
Okay. Well,
and is that what Marina's having glimpses of?
Okay, so the first of all, I think the idea that time is very much related to our memory, I think, is absolutely correct. But I think that we live in a constant present that advances very fast. So, for example, now that I've finished this sentence, we are already in a time future relative to when you ask the question. So we have this relentless advancement in time that is occurring, and is really the result of all the events that are happening in one's biologies and that are just sheer duration. Now, the appreciation that we have of the time is very much related to a certain level of function. So if you are conscious the way most people are in this room, probably all, the level must be very similar, unless somebody's dozing off after all of these considerations. So if you have that, you will have an appreciation of time that is very similar. But if you would take a certain number of drugs that I could mention, your perception of time would change incredibly. Why? Because those molecules that you would be ingesting would be changing the way the neural networks that allow you to experience time would work under the action of those drugs. So all of this is very relative to the biological moment, to the state in which your brain is operating. Now, in terms of the future, when you ask, well, would it be possible, for example, to have a perception of the future? I don't even know what that would mean in strict biological scientific terms, because how can you perceive something that has not happened? All the different events that are that will potentially happen have not happened yet. So I think it's difficult to perceive the future in that sense. However, it's perfectly possible to perceive something that you plan ahead for the future. So and this is what I was touching on with the notion of memories of the future. We, unlike most other species, have an inordinate capacity to make plans. We are able to have a very clear idea of what we want to do tomorrow, even tonight, or in 6 months from now. And people engage in this planning in a very robust fashion. Some people actually daydream about their plans all the time and they don't do anything. Now, that is really future in the true sense of the term, but is a future that has not happened yet and that we can glimpse by going into those plans. But what is so fascinating is the way we are caught in this ever-present between the past and this future that has not yet taken place.
But then if you don't move and you do nothing at all, and being in present, there is no time.
Exactly. Time is very much, I mean, your present enlarges enormously, and your and the motion of time is, at least in terms of your perception, is changed. Yeah. It's a way of getting to immortality.
And of course. And now the last question.
I wonder how you talk a lot about how things biologically affect how we think, but what about digital technology and new technologies? How does that impact and change perhaps the structure of how we approach things, how we consider ourselves in the world?
Yeah, what a wonderful question. Yeah, I think that it would be very, very strange if the developments of the digital revolution would not be having already an enormous impact on how our brains work and how our consciousness is organized. So I think that's a very excellent question. I can give you another example of something that has already changed without the digital revolution, but has probably changed over the past century, and that is the tremendous influence of movies. We have now had over a century of movie viewing, and we have, you know, until movies came about, people knew about the events in the world. They knew about what other people did through theater, through novels, through, you know, direct storytelling. But now, and for a long time, we have been knowing also, and more, through visual images. And I would be very surprised if that has not had an enormous impact in how we construct our world, in how we construct images of ourselves. And I think with the digital revolution, something very similar is happening. We are entirely surrounded by screens in our life, in our day-to-day. And something else that is happening at the level of the digital that can be both a problem and an advantage. And it has to do with the fact that digital technology has allowed us to do multitasking in very, very, I think, dangerous ways. There's, you know, you're probably aware of the fact that now there are certain accidents that take place on roads or accidents that take place with trains because the conductors were not paying attention to the red signal that would have made them stop. This is a side effect of that technology. But that's not the worst part. The worst part may be that when you multitask, although you are obviously expanding the operations of your brain and you're making your brain attend to multiple objects, which is in itself potentially and maybe really an advantage, you're also obliging that brain to divide the acquisition of information through all of those different objects that you're now attending to. And whether or not that will have an impact on how much you learn, it's not something that we know yet. So I think that on balance, who would dispute the fact that we have enormous advantages coming from the fact that we have email and we can communicate much more amply, and we have access to information at much higher levels than we've ever had before. The question is how you filter all that and how you're going to cope with the potential downside of that excess of information.
I would like to finish tonight with some dose of pessimism. I think that our brain is developing much slower than technology does. And I think on the end, technology is going to kill us. So the only chance we still have is to go back to simplicity. Thank you.